I was actually looking forward to.
It was hell is the only way to describe it, because we were put in a situation where we had no control over anything that happened to us.
By this time, I had begun to ask myself, do I exist? Am I a human being? Am I dead?
Being in constant fear all the time, not knowing what's going to happen to you. One soldier was saying that you killed my family in the Twin Towers, that he was going to kill me.
You can't help but to think that at some point you're going to die. When they put a black bag over your head and put you in a kneeling position and you hear that sound, you think they're going to blow my head off.
It was a concrete floor, the cage on top. If it rained, the rainwater would come into yourself, you'd get soaked. We had one bucket in one corner with water in there.
One, two, three, one way, and the wall. One, two, three, the other way, and the wall. So just three steps, forward, backward, forward, backward, forward, backward, like that. So it seems crazy if I say to you that I was looking forward to going to Guantanamo, but you have to understand why.
We were never told that we were going to Guantanamo. We were just taken out of Kandahar prison, and that was it. We weren't told what was happening.
This was a transport aeroplane. I couldn't see anything, but it was evident there's no seats here. We were put onto the floor and seated like this, with the feet out and hands behind the back.
On the plane, going there, we were chained to the floor. Our hands were chained together. We had goggles over our eyes, earmuffs over our ears.
Face mask on my mouth, and blackened goggles on my eyes, and then on top of that they put a hood. I don't know why.
As our feet were chained to the floor, we couldn't move. If we tried to move our feet forward, somebody would come and kick your feet and move them back.
And next to me there was, I think, a Libyan man. He said, "Brother, it's time for prayer." In that position, he told me. I said, "Yes, of course." When I spoke, an American soldier came up to me. "Listen, you Muslim mother, if you speak again, I'll slit your throat." At that point, the brother said, "Allahu Akbar," and he began to pray.
America's oldest overseas naval base is located in a country with which the United States has no diplomatic relations. The base, situated on the southeastern tip of Cuba, is home to a prison which history will never forget. Outside the jurisdiction of US law, Guantanamo Bay Detention Camp is a prison where detainees are deprived of protection under the Geneva Conventions. But that was not a position held by politicians in the United States.
And that must have been for about 15, 16 hours we was in that position. Then we landed somewhere, we were taken off the plane, searched. Although we'd been chained all this time, we were still searched.
Flash, flash, flash. And you know that these are pictures being taken. But this is not official pictures, this is trophy pictures. So they can go back and tell people, look what we caught. We caught this scum.
I think we're now down to sorting out the really bad guys.
And what's taking place down there is responsible, it's humane, it's legal, it's proper, it's consistent with the Geneva Convention.
He took me into a room, they took the sack off and chained my feet to the floor.
Then I felt some cold steel against my leg. And the cold steel cut off my clothes, ripped off my clothes. It was a knife.
And one was cutting my hair and my beard and the other was cutting the clothes off my body.
And I was naked then.
They stripped us and they took us outside in front of all the soldiers. But we couldn't see nothing because they kept their sacks over our heads. But there's a lot of soldiers laughing and you could tell that there's even female soldiers there, male soldiers, female soldiers, that they just did that to humiliate us. There's no other reason to do it.
One of the effects of putting a hood over somebody's head and knowing that there are armed guards around you, the image that everybody has is that before a person is executed, he has a hood placed over his head. So that is the constant feeling that you have in your mind, that at some point someone's going to blow my head off, going to hang me, going to slit my throat. That's the feeling that you have, and that's what they intend to do. And they took me into this place where it was a shipping container that had been converted into a cell. So it was tiny, really tiny. It was like smaller than a toilet.
And that was the first time I ever got to actually see anything. When they closed the door of the cell, they told me to take the goggles off and hand them to. And that was when I saw all I could see was cages with people in orange in. And I thought, what the hell am I? On some paper that he wanted me to read the rules of the camp. Basically, he said you can't do anything in the camp. There's a whole thing that no talking. You cannot talk to the person next to you. You cannot talk to the person in front of you. That whatever the soldiers say, you have to do. You have no rights here.
The latest methods in torture and interrogation were tested there. The standard operations procedures were simple. It was enough for the soldiers who worked there to forget that their prisoners were human beings, at least for the most part.
The fact remains that treatment is proper, and there's no doubt in my mind that it is humane and appropriate and consistent with the Geneva Convention for the most part.
Basically, being in American detention, the way they try to degrade you and make you like an animal is, the first thing they do is they put you into, it's not even a cell, it's a cage where you'd put animals in a zoo.
I could take three steps, one, two, three, one way, and the wall. One, two, three, the other way. And the wall. So just three steps, forward, backward, forward, backward, forward, backward, like that. Three steps one way, three steps back.
On a daily basis, we had no communication with the outside world. We had no communication with lawyers or anything. And being in constant fear all the time, not knowing what's going to happen to you.
Every day is like the next day. Total isolation, complete isolation. Near the end of the second year, they moved me into an area where for the first time in Guantanamo, I saw other detainees.
One particular person that I know, his name's Umar Qadar. He's from Canada and he's still there. And he was 14 when he was taken to Guantanamo.
They'd operated on his chest and his chest had been opened and then they stitched up his chest. So you could see the whole scar marks from the recent operation. And the Americans, they hated him like anything. They hated him, they treated him very badly. They treated him like an animal.
He was 14 then, yeah. He was shot three times in the chest, and he was put into adult prison, which is against American constitution anyway, that they can't have juveniles in adult prisons.
The Americans raided the village where he lived. They killed everybody around him, and he was one left alive. When the special forces came in to clear up, they were shooting the dead bodies. He was still alive. He took a grenade from one of the dead bodies and he threw it. And he killed one of the American soldiers. When they came and they saw him, they blasted him with a shotgun. So that's where all the marks were on his chest and he lost his eye as well.
My arms, I'm all over.
Every day. You had that type of interrogation, being punched, being kicked, being beaten, watching other people being beaten, humiliated, being stripped naked, having no communication at all with the world, having for 2 years no hot meal, no hot drink, no vegetables, no fruit.
There was one guy who used to be opposite me, and every 10 minutes they used to move him. He'd never get any sleep. 24 hours a day, every 10 minutes they'd move him. And just because his interrogator said so. And make it difficult for him. He never used to get any sleep.
Why are they doing it? They don't know. They're only doing it because somebody's told them. But, you know, in the middle of any type of situation where there's conflict, reasonableness and thoughtfulness gets thrown out of the window and it's just back to animal instincts.
Humanity denied, that a detainee might be innocent was not even considered a distant possibility. By now, even admitting this to the media was a simple matter.
The basic answer is we are at war. The legal instruments were developed essentially for civilian time, for civilian society.
There was one soldier who was walking past my cell and he was humming a song that I knew. And I turned around and he said, that's that song. Like, it must have been Eminem or something. I can't remember which song it was. And he was shocked. He went, oh my God, how do you know that? I said, yeah, I listened to it. And this is that name of the album and that's the song. And he was shocked.
I think in the mind of soldiers who were given the duty to guard us, they'd initially believed what they were told, that these people are dangerous, don't talk to them, they are highly manipulative.
I think it's in South Carolina, they have a briefing there that they're told these are the most dangerous people in the world and they'll kill you. Even if you put your finger, if they get one finger out of their cell and touch you, that they can kill you.
At the same time, they also designated another terminology used to describe us was enemy alien, which means he's an enemy of the country and he's an alien. He's not a human being, he's an alien. He's something foreign.
My number was 086, and that's what they used to call me during the whole time. If it's not 086, it's your cell number.
558, that was the number. They gave me a number. 558, you're going for a walk. That means lie on the floor, put your hands over your head, put your legs together and cross them.
You go to such a stage that you start believing that you are an animal, you're not even human anymore.
Then there's a person up in the corner with an M16 pointing it. You hear it. Then another man comes with a handgun, points it towards you. Then they open the cage and three people run in very fast. One jumps on your head like and with the knee into the head, one into the back. They shackle your legs, shackle your hands, then they pick you up quickly.
The way they look at you, the way they treat you, when they come to take you out of your cell, they run in, pin you to the floor, like I'm some kind of caged animal that I might attack them.
And I thought, my goodness, I'm only 5'3". You know, I'm a very short man, I'm not big. Why are they so afraid? Why so afraid? I didn't understand that, and they did that with everybody, every time they moved them out of the cell. I was interrogated over 300 times, at least. And some of those interrogations were very harsh.
In Guantanamo, I don't know, you lose count. There's so many times that you'd get interrogated. Sometimes you wouldn't be interrogated for 6-7 months. And sometimes you'd be interrogated 2-3 times a day.
One of the CIA interrogators was probably the most frightening, and he was intelligent. He was one of the few intelligence officers who really was intelligent. And he sat with me in interrogation once for 2 hours. And he didn't say one word. He remained silent. The two FBI guys on either side talked, answered questions, non-stop firing. He remained silent, and he looked at me, and he didn't blink once. Not once did he do that. And his eyes were blue, burning blue, and he just sat and stared. And then the two FBI agents, they left. And he stood there, still sat there, and he said, "Mazen Beg."
Tying our feet to the floor, then putting our hands between our feet and tying us and putting us in difficult situations where we can't take the pain. And the interrogation rooms, they've got AC units, and they used to turn them really low, so it'd be freezing in there. And this is for hours and hours. And then later on, they started playing really, really loud music.
In one of the cases, they had the sound of a woman next door screaming. And the things they were shouting to her, "You bitch, open your legs," all of these type of things they were shouting to her. And I knew it was a woman, and my blood boiled. But then they took pictures of my wife, my children, that they saved from my house, and they waved them in front of me. "Where do you think your family is? Where do you think your wife is?" And the scream next door at the same time. They started putting things in my mind as if to say that she's next door, as if it's her. "What do you think's happened to them? Do you think they're free?" This is the type of things that they did. And
next morning, we were woken up, and they told me to come out to the front of the cell. They put a sack over my head, and they took me to a different part, into a room, which was like a tent. And I was sat on the floor, and as soon as I sat on the floor, they took the sack off my head, and there was three people sitting in front of me. There was a soldier sitting in the corner with the handgun.
That I was taken naked, first of all, initially, with a hood over my head. Then they lifted up the hood, and I saw two people from the FBI. They got FBI hats on. And I thought, this is the world-famous FBI. These are decent people, surely. I've seen so many programs about them, and they do good things. And they just stood there saying, "When's the last time you saw Osama bin Laden? When's the last time you saw Mullah Omar?" And they asked this of each detainee.
"Yes, we are members of Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden sent us on a mission, and we are responsible 9/11. That's all they wanted to hear. That's what they wanted to hear. And whatever we said, they said, "No, we haven't done anything wrong. If you contact the British authorities, they'll explain to you that during this 9/11, we were in the UK.
And then they said, "Oh, you speak English?" I said, "Yeah, because I'm from England, and that's what they speak in England." And they said, what are you doing here?" I said, "I didn't come here of my own accord. You brought me here by force." It was on the night of the 31st of January 2002, 12 o'clock, midnight precisely. There was a knock on the door, and I was surprised. This is very late. So I went to open the door. I saw a whole group of people, and they pushed me. They didn't ask me who I was, and I was very scared because I thought these are bandits. They had guns in their hands. One of them had an electric stun gun, so it was crackling. My first thought again was my family, what are they doing? But they pushed me onto the ground on my knees, put a hood over my head, tied the back of my hands, tied my legs. Somebody lifted my head up and pulled up the hood, and then took a picture. And the person who took the picture, it was evident to me that this guy is Caucasian, he's white. And then he produced a pair of handcuffs, and he said, "Do you know who gave me these handcuffs?" I said, "I don't even know who you are." And he spoke in an American accent, so it's obvious. He said, "I was given these handcuffs by one of the wives of the victims of the September 11th attacks." I said, "Wouldn't she think, this wife that you're doing this for, think that you're a stupid man because you caught the wrong person?"
Before all this happened, I was in university in Birmingham studying network engineering, and I was had a part-time job in an electrical store.
In 2001, I made the decision to move to Afghanistan, to Kabul, with my family, to teach at the school, with my wife being there, also to teach the girls.
Basically, we went to Pakistan for my friend's wedding. That was the main reason that we went. And we were staying in Karachi at that time.
And there was a separate project. We had to build a boys' school, and we did other projects to build wells in the drought-stricken regions, because there was a drought at that period. So there were many other projects that we were able to do.
Still in shock from the 9/11 bombings, the US soldiers at Guantanamo were convinced that each and every one of the detainees were themselves responsible for bringing down the Twin Towers.
Each day that passed without my family was a day lost, a day that it could never be recovered ever again. And each damn time that it happened, I thought of my children. They're growing up without me. How dare these people take that away from them? They haven't just affected my life. They've destroyed those children's lives.
I've lost 2.5 years of my life, and I'm never going to get that back. And during that period, I lost 3 members of my family while I was in Guantanamo, and I'm never going to see them again. And that's hard for me, because they never let me have any communication with my family, so I never knew what was going on.
I also know another side of America, the side of America that I felt, you know, that only happens in extreme circumstances. The side of America that invades Vietnam, the side of America that drops bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the side of America that uses napalm, the side of America that has a very brutal CIA intelligence agency that operates in Nicaragua and in Panama and these places. I knew that existed, but I just put it aside. But now I started to see it.
Prior to everything that's happened to me, my view of Americans was that somewhere where I'd love to go, and never in my life would I have thought that I'd have hatred towards them.
The iguana, which is a lizard, is protected. It's a protected species in Guantanamo Bay. If a soldier or a civilian damages that iguana, he can expect to pay a fine of up to $10,000 if he damages this lizard. This lizard has rights, but the human being, the detainees, have no rights at all. President Bush himself has designated me as one of the most dangerous men on earth. That's who you're talking to right now. He designated people in Guantanamo Bay, particularly the people from the West, as the most dangerous. What's his evidence for that? There isn't any.
Remember, these are the ones in Guantanamo Bay are killers. They don't share the same values we share.
But what he didn't know was that this kind of thinking could turn innocent people into dangerous enemies.
The reality was, I wasn't an enemy of the United States, and I wasn't a fighter. But that didn't make any difference, because as far as they're concerned, the whole world is a battlefield. And as far as they're concerned, everybody who's not with us is against us. Many, you know, later when I was in Guantanamo, one of the American soldiers actually said to me, "Mozam, if you weren't a terrorist before you came here, I bet you will be by the time you leave. Because if somebody did to me what we've done to you, that's what I would do."
They made a mistake telling the world about Guantanamo and bringing people here. And the next time we do it, the world won't know.
And it was very frightening, because I know the capacity that exists, but particularly within a country that's powerful, when it feels that it can do whatever it likes.
One day it's happened to me, and next day it could happen to you.